We have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover, starting with local. And this was a big week for initiatives. The deadline, I believe, was this week.
Yeah, Friday was the deadline for initiatives to turn in signatures to qualify for the ballot in November. Each initiative had to get about 241,000 signatures. The good news is that Initiative 1098, the one that would impose a tax on rich people, turned in about 350,000 signatures. So it looks like once those signatures are verified, it will probably qualify for the ballot. But the bad news is that the Legalized Marijuana Initiative fell short of the signatures that they needed.
Yeah, usually the margin of error is if you figure you get more than 300,000 or so signatures, and that's enough to cover the duplicate signatures and the ineligible voters and so forth. So 1098 is almost certainly in. 1068 is not, although their organizers are saying that they will definitely be back next year, and they intend to move forward this year with fundraising for an initiative effort next year. The folks behind 1068 were relatively inexperienced and never got the money that they needed to hire paid signature gatherers. The whole process this year really underscores the fact that you need paid signature gatherers and you need big bucks backing in order to get a signature on the, to get an initiative on the ballot. In Washington state at this point. Most of this, the initiatives that are going to be on the ballot this November, did have big money behind them, and we've really seen the corruption of the process in a big way this year. I-1053, which is Tim Eymann's initiative to require a two-thirds legislative supermajority in order to get tax hikes, that has had major corporate backing this year. We have two separate initiatives, one by Costco and one by, one backed by a major wholesaler in order to dismantle the state liquor store monopoly and allow sale of hard liquor in private stores. And we have I-1107, which is the American Beverage Association and Coke and Pepsi's effort to stop the new surtax soda and
candy and
pop and yeah. Candy and gum. So you have all of these different initiatives where it's major corporate backing that has enabled them to pay the signature gatherers, like the I-1107, up to $3 a signature to get them on the ballot. And I-1068 just didn't have those kind of deep pockets. They had a commitment at one point, an informal commitment anyway, from SEIU and the Democratic Party in order to provide some of that backing and help them. But those parties wound up backing out on that commitment and changing their mind. And they just couldn't make up the shortfall.
Yeah. And it's interesting, the Legalized Marijuana Initiative supporters said, well, you know, we didn't make it to the ballot this year. We're going to try again next year. But I think some of that's going to depend on whether or not one of the two or both of the privatized liquor initiatives pass. What I'm interested in is what happens if both initiatives pass.
Yeah,
the ballot.
The reason that's relevant is that unfortunately 1068 did not deal with how to distribute or how to regulate distribution of marijuana if it does get decriminalized. They wanted to put that in the initiatives, but they ran up against the old bugaboo of Tim Eymann, which is that you can't have two separate things in one initiative.
Yeah.
And they were told by their legal counsel and the various people that they consulted that decriminalizing possession and dealing with the distribution would count as two separate topics. But that in turn leads it to the legislature to decide that. And the simplest way, of course, for the state to oversee distribution is if they use the existing network of state liquor stores. Well, if those are dismantled by initiative this year with either 1100 or 1105, and polling shows that it's very likely that either one or both of those will pass this year, then that avenue is not going to be available next year.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me, too, is people might look at the two liquor initiatives and think they're the same, but they're not. One of them, I-1100, the one that's backed by Costco and other big wholesale retailers, that initiative would dismantle the state's control over liquor, and it would have a big impact on how it is priced and how much revenue the state would get over liquor sales. I-1105 wouldn't do that. So there's some conflict between the two. So if they both pass, it's going to be kind of interesting to try to figure out what is the state supposed to do then in that case.
Particularly because the state legislature is barred from amending either initiative for 2 years after it passes.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you get two that pass that are both conflicting,
what do you do in that time frame? Yeah.
Do you know how long the window is to collect signatures? Can initiatives start like right now to collect for next time around? Or
no, the initiatives have to they can't be filed until January, and then there's the process where the state the Secretary of State has to approve
the wording
on it and the actual petition and whatnot. So the actual window is only about 3 months. And one of the things that sunk the volunteer effort for 1068 was that the weather's been so bad in Western Washington this year. It really was a stroke of bad luck, because if you'd had larger crowds at events like Folk Life and some of the street Fremont Fair, and so, which was dead, especially on Sunday this year, some of the other larger crowds, they would have had a better chance. But that unfortunately, what didn't happen.
Yep.
All right. Well, moving on, and speaking of dead, the South Park Bridge had its funeral this last week.
Yeah, on Wednesday, June 30th, the South Park Bridge closed, and for the last time, it carried vehicle traffic over it. Folks who haven't been paying attention, the South Park Bridge connects the community of South Park with downtown over the Duwamish Waterway. Closing the bridge is going to cut off the residents of South Park. It's going to force them to drive now over to First Avenue and take that bridge, and that corridor is already congested. So it's kind of interesting. There was a lot of media coverage because on Wednesday, the South Park community held a wake for the bridge. And of course, a lot of cameras showed up and they had little spots on the news on TV about how isn't it a shame that the South Park Bridge closed and politicians haven't come up with the money to replace it. And it's just a sign of our bad economic times.
Did they actually talk about the politicians not coming up with the money?
Well, in a couple places they did. But
I thought it was just like an act of God.
They didn't mention that the South Park Bridge has been on the political slate for replacement for some 10 or 15 years. And over the course of 10 or 15 years, local politicians from the city of Seattle to King County to Washington State Legislature to our two U.S. senators have not done the work that they needed to do to get the money to replace it. It wasn't until just this last year when it looked like, oh gosh, nobody has put forward any money. The city of Seattle has poured all this money into the Mercer Corridor project. Instead, that King County stepped forward to organize some $80 million to help replace the bridge. Some of that money is from King County. Some of that's from the city of Seattle. Some of it's from the port of Seattle. But it's still about $50 million short of the $130 million they need to build a replacement bridge. And they could have gotten, our U.S. senators could have gotten money, particularly Patty Murray, could have gotten money for the additional $50 million if they had emphasized that, with the Appropriations Committee in D.C., if they had emphasized that the South Park Bridge replacement is more important than the Mercer Corridor Beautification Project. They didn't do that. They went instead for promoting the Mercer Corridor Project, and they got a lot of money for that from the federal government and nothing for the South Park Bridge. So it really tells you something about the political priorities here in the city of Seattle and in Western Washington that, we can pour money into a project to benefit Paul Allen and the residents of Queen Anne and the wealthy parts of Seattle, but we can't do anything for the working-class residents of the South Park neighborhood.
Yeah, Paul Allen lived in South Park, it would have been a different story.
It would have been a very different story.
The other comparison that I think is really interesting is I believe the South Park Bridge is either comparable or less money than is being put into or was put into the Magnolia Bridge.
Oh, yeah.
Which, again, you have an aging bridge that's damaged, that's a safety hazard, that is one of the only ways to get into a particular neighborhood. In the case of the Magnolia Bridge, which was damaged in the Nisqually earthquake, money was prioritized to replace it almost immediately.
Yeah.
Whereas with South Park, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting comparison, I think, was I had a guest on last week who said the Navy's Growler aircraft, it cost about $70 million a pop. So just one of those, it'd buy a new bridge. So, all right, moving on. The Seattle School Board taking a vote this week?
Yeah. Coming up this coming Wednesday at the monthly school board meeting, the school board is likely to vote to extend the contract of Superintendent Maria Goodloe Johnson for another year. That recommendation has already been made by the executive board of the school board. And it's somewhat controversial, although you would never know it from our newspaper of Occasional Record, which is very much in the corner of Goodloe Johnson and the school board and all other things from the insider downtown clique that likes to think that it runs Seattle. Maria Goodloe Johnson has actually been quite controversial recently. In fact, there have been no confidence votes on the superintendent from the faculties at Ballard's High School, Franklin High School, a number of middle schools and elementary schools before the end of the school year. And this past week, also the Seattle Teachers Union, over 100 representatives from the different schools around the city voted unanimously to ask the school board to delay its decision to extend Goodloe Johnson's contract until 2013. That apparently is not going to happen. The board is almost certainly going to rubber stamp that, even though a number of questions have been raised about Goodloe Johnson, and not just the obvious ones about like the school closures and then turning around and having to reopen five schools at a much higher cost. The school closures a couple of years ago saved $3.5 million, whereas reopening five schools after they miscalculated on 2009's enrollment cost some $47.5 million. You had the toxic fumes that closed down a brand new school building this past year. Some of those have been fairly widely publicized, but some of the things that are specific to Goodloe Johnson and the downtown board that has dominated the majority of the school board for the last 3 years have not been well publicized. Goodloe Johnson in particular sits on a couple of boards that are very troubling in terms of their conflict of interest. One is called the Broad Foundation, which is a hobby horse of a Los Angeles billionaire called Eli Broad, which engages in something called venture philanthropy, which is to say that it gives money to school districts, but it wants a return on that investment. The Broad Foundation is very heavily into promoting a network of charter schools in urban areas around the country, and also into promoting mayoral control of school districts, which is to say that it wants to get different school districts to appoint school boards rather than having them elected by the electorate. Goodloe Johnson is on the board of the Broad Foundation. She has also hired several alumni from the Broad Foundation to work in the Seattle School District's headquarters at the Stanford Center, and has also accepted $1 million in a grant from the Broad Foundation that nobody's actually quite clear what that money is for. Goodloe Johnson's also on the board of the company that has created and distributed something called MAP, the Measures for Academic Progress, which is another standardized test that's been created in the wake of No Child Left Behind. She then procured $9 million from the Gates Foundation for the Seattle School District to use the MAP test 3 times a year for everything from kindergartners through the 9th grade. So she...
That's a conflict of interest.
That's a direct conflict of interest because she's then using Seattle School District money obtained from the Gates Foundation in order to pay a company that she sits on the board of for standardized testing, which most of the rest of the state in the wake of the WASL debacle is moving away from. So there have been a lot of troubling things about Goodloe Johnson that are not being covered in local media that the school board, there are a lot of parents and a lot of teachers that are deeply troubled by. One of the other things about the Broad Foundation is that they're very actively hostile to teachers' unions. Surprise, surprise. Mm-hmm. A lot of these issues are percolating under the surface, and it's got a lot of parents and a lot of teachers upset, but you're not hearing anything about it in local media, and it looks like the board is going to go ahead and simply rubber stamp Goodloe Johnson to do more of the same.
All right. Moving on, the Washington State Supreme Court seeing some cases coming up here soon.
Yeah. In fact, the Supreme Court decided yesterday that it is going to hear the case being brought against State Attorney General Rob McKenna by City Attorney Peter Holmes. Holmes has filed suit against McKenna to force McKenna to stop his involvement in the Republican lawsuit against Obama's health care reform plan that was initiated by Florida's Attorney General and that McKenna signed on to a couple of months ago. Holmes making the case that it's an overstep of authority by McKenna in order to sign on to this without a specific request from the governor or the legislature or a State Department. And it's very interesting that in its decision to take on this case, the State Supreme Court yesterday, as part of its ruling, made a pronouncement which was very, very similar to the issues that are being brought up in another case that the state will actually hear on Thursday. That's the case between McKenna and State Commissioner of Public Lands Peter Goldmark over a case where McKenna is refusing Goldmark, who is a Democrat, and McKenna is a Republican. McKenna is refusing Goldmark's direct request to appeal a lower court ruling on the case of a PUD district in Okanagan County that wants to take State Department the state land basically for a high wire transmission tower. And the issue in this case is that State Department heads and elected officials like Goldmark are their attorney is the Attorney General, and the Attorney General is required by statute to take on cases that they and to represent the state as his client. And McKenna is saying that he has the right to pick and choose which cases he takes on and which cases he doesn't take on in the public interest, whether or not they're desired by other elected officials in the state. In other words, he's acting as his own free agent rather than as somebody who represents the best interests of the states or state's elected officials or state citizens. It's a huge constitutional issue, and once again, it's getting almost no media coverage because the local media, particularly the Seattle Times, would very much like to see Rob McKenna run for governor in 2012 and doesn't want to publicize anything that might make him look bad. But this is something that's going to go to the state Supreme Court on Thursday and be heard, and it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out.
All right. Moving on to national and Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan making the rounds this week.
Yeah, it was an interesting week for the court system at the national level, too. There are no real surprises in the Elena Kagan testimony. She has, as with most Supreme Court nominees, she kept her answers very vague, and she's expected to, she will be the next Supreme Court justice. There's really no question about that. But what was really interesting was the line of questioning from Republican senators. It just shows you how far to the right the Republican Party has lurched in modern times, that a new generation of African Americans got to witness Republican senators excoriating Kagan because she considered Thurgood Marshall a positive influence on the Supreme Court. And a positive influence for having litigated Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. That's right. You had the spectacle of Republican senators one after another this week saying Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka was a bad thing. It really was an appalling spectacle.
That was the case that desegregated schools in the U.S. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, you know, we're also seeing the resegregation of schools. One of the criticisms of Goodloe Johnson actually was that the neighborhood plan that she's overseen has contributed to the resegregation of schools in Seattle. But, nonetheless, that was a landmark decision, not just for schools, but for the entire culture of Jim Crow in this country when it was made in 1954. And, Thurgood Marshall litigated that case as a private lawyer and then later as a representative for the NAACP, and then later was appointed to the Supreme Court and played a trailblazing role in the Supreme Court as well. That whole history is being rewritten by the conservative movement in this country, and it's really scary how reactionary it has become and how far from the mainstream it is swayed in recent years.
All right. Also this week, nationally, the Supreme Court weighing in on the right to arm bears.
Yeah, exactly. It was not a good week for grizzlies. Wait, it was the other way around. Yeah, the right to have a well-armed militia no longer applies in the United States. That's because the Supreme Court threw out that bit about militias this week and ruled, and this is a direct quote, that the Second Amendment provides Americans a fundamental right to bear arms that cannot be violated by state and local government. That is to say that it no longer has anything to do with a well-regulated militia, no longer has anything to do with regulation at all. And if that decision is taken as it reads by lower courts, it basically means that states and local governments no longer have any right to contribute, no longer have any right to control what types of weapons are sold, where they may be carried, anything like that. So you have the spectacle of people being able to take, you know, fully automatic machine guns into bars at this point. I mean, it just, it's insane. But it really, again, shows you the consequences several years ago of the Democrats ruling over on the nominations of Alito and Roberts to the Supreme Court and what that conservative majority is going to mean for court cases in the United States for the next 20 years or so, or at least until that majority can be shaken.
All right. That moves us on then to international and the G20 summit that happened this last week.
Yeah, the G20 summit that started on Saturday and ended a couple of days later. What I found very interesting about the G20 meeting is it was in Toronto, and so there was a lot of it about it in the Canadian news and just a little bit about it in the U.S. news. And mostly what you saw in the U.S. news is pictures of some of the violence in the streets of a few protesters smashing windows and burning two police cars, and not a whole lot of coverage on any other aspects of it. What I found very interesting...
Including the police violence.
Yeah. What I found very interesting was when I started looking at it is that there's this big brouhaha in Canada over the costs of security at the G20 summit. Because in Canadian dollars, Canada has spent $1 billion, well, more than $1 billion at this point, to provide security.
And the Canadian dollar, for people who don't know, is actually worth more than the U.S. dollar at this point.
Yeah, so it's like, so here you have Canada spending more than triple what Japan did in 2008 for the G20 summit, and basically pulling together something like 13% of the nation's entire police force to occupy the city of Toronto. And then if you go online and you look at some of the videos of the demonstrations, you see that the police were pretty violent when it came to dealing with the peaceful demonstrators. But when a small group broke off and decided they were going to smash windows and burn a couple of police cars, there was no sign of any police presence at all following that group of people or trying to come in and stop them from setting those two police cars on fire, et cetera.
And unless, of course, the police were comprised of those small groups.
Yeah, and there's an interesting video on YouTube where it shows a phalanx of police in plain clothes carrying sticks and other weapons who are pretending to be dressing like and pretending to be demonstrators. And you can tell that they are plainclothes policemen because they're all over 6 feet. They're, you know, pot bellies, gray hair, mustaches. They look exactly like cops going to a barbecue. And when they're running down the street in formation, they're carrying sticks in their hands. They're not in uniform. There's no indication that they are police until you see the police line part and allow them through and then close up behind them and turn to the demonstrators with cameras and start shouting at them, stop filming, get out of here, get back, et cetera, et cetera. And in the midst of those plainclothes police, you see a guy running with them who is dressed just like a black bloc protester, the group of people that broke off from the peaceful protest and started smashing windows and stuff. So it really raises the question of, did the Toronto police decide that in order, and did the Toronto mayor and politicians decide, well, we need to justify the expense of all of the security for the summit meeting by creating a reason, you know, by sprinkling the demonstrators with agitators who would spark violence, let them have their fun on a couple of blocks of the city where they smashed up a McDonald's and smashed the windows of a Starbucks and burned two cop cars. And then we can move in afterwards and say, well, gosh, see, this is what we have to do for these summit meetings. We have to spend all this money for cops, paying them overtime and buying fancy new equipment for the police department. Because look, there's always going to be this violent element no matter where we have the summit meetings. So it was very interesting to see, and you saw none of that on the media coverage of the event. And then it was interesting. I was watching too, looking for what was the coverage of what actually happened in the summit meeting. And what I found interesting is that the only announcement made on what actually happened within the summit meeting had to do with European nations and the U.S. coming forward and saying, well, we've come to this agreement that we need to cut our deficits in half by 2013. And then, of course, the footnote was, well, that's not really a strict deadline to cut deficits.
Because it's blatantly impossible.
Yeah, because it's impossible in this economic climate. And so we were presented once again with the choice that a standard economist would give of you have to either spend lots and lots of money to prop up the economy and save the economy and run governments into debt, deeper into debt, or the other alternative is, well, we cut the deficits by cutting public spending, which will tank the economy. That's the choice here. And of course, the Obama administration's line is, oh, well, we can do both. We just have to balance out. And I look at that and I just go, well, where's the third option? And the third option is we can cut public spending on the things we don't need, like the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, military procurement, you know, propping up the housing market
and
with
things
tax
that, and
credits.
Things that have no economic impact.
Yeah, propping up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And we can cut the housing market loose and decide that we're not gonna try to rely on that as a way to save the economy, because the housing market is you just can't prop it up at this point. We're going to let it go. You can cut your unnecessary expenses, turn around, take that extra money to help pay down the debt and fund the social programs and infrastructure expenses that we need to stimulate the economy. But of course, nobody is talking about doing that.
That's
socialism.
Bear in mind that military expenditures in the United States budget make well over 50% of the discretionary spending.
Yes.
That is the non-trust fund spending.
So you would recoup a lot of money if you just cut off the military.
Yeah, at least cut off the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and some of the really, really expensive and unnecessary military hardware projects. You know, the Boeing pipeline, the Lockheed mm-hmm. Martin pipeline, where Congress routinely funds projects that the armed forces don't even want. Because they're politically advantageous.
And they don't create jobs here in the U.S. because most of those jobs are now overseas.
Yeah. And the jobs that they do create, they create at a far lower level than almost any other sector of the economy spending would mm-hmm. would do.
So I found it very interesting the coverage of the G20 event didn't discuss these very basic issues at all.
But did discuss those two police cars.
Yeah, they did. They had lots of pictures of them.
All right. Any events this week?
Aside from an International Day of Mourning tomorrow, no critical events in this coming week. But although there is a thing going on at Town Hall on Thursday and some other things that are on the state calendar.
Very good.
So people can check that out.
All right.
But it usually gets a little quiet in the summer. Yes, it is summer. You can't really tell by looking outside, but it is in fact summer.
The calendar says it is.
Just wait until July 5th, then summer will appear.
Right. Talking as we do every week with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchuk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
The very last regularly scheduled print issue of Eat the State is now out and around in bookstores and cafes in the King County Library System. Grab your collector's copy while you can. Although we will have have other print issues coming up, particularly for the the next one will be on July 29th, I believe, for the endorsements for the primary that's coming up in August. But you can also find regularly updated material, including a whole bunch of stories that went up yesterday, including one that that outlines some of the problems with Maria Goodloe Johnson I mentioned, and a fairly detailed blog entry as well on all the initiatives that were filed yesterday. That's at the Eat the State website, the brand new site. It's at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback on any of the things you've heard on the show, you can email us at info@eatthestate.org. We also have a brand new Facebook page that's up. You can look for that. And we are looking for both a new calendar editor and editing help for the new website. So if you're interested in that, email us at editorial@eatthestate.org, and we'll be happy to hook you up.
All right. I should also mention that Mind Over Matters has a Facebook page now as well.
Oh, cool.
Great.